From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a novelist whose first love was poetry, and a former presidential candidate who believed in the political system in spite of the many absurdities he found within it. We remember poet and novelist James Dickey, the author of Deliverance, and former Senator Paul Tsongas, with interviews from the archives. Both died last weekend. Also, Milo Miles reintroduces us to singer Tracy Nelson. Some of her best work has been reissued. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers veteran bluesman ZZ Hill. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we remember Paul Tsongas. The former senator from Massachusetts died Saturday at the age of 55. He had pneumonia and a liver problem related to his treatments for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a slow-growing cancer of the lymph system. In 1984, he left the Senate because of cancer. He had a bone marrow transplant in 1986 that appeared to leave him cancer-free. Last May, he had another transplant to correct a bone marrow disorder that can occur in people who have recovered from lymph cancer. His medical history was an issue when he ran for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1992. In the campaign, he was also criticized for a lack of charisma, but I thought he showed a good sense of humor and irony about himself and American politics when we spoke later that year after he dropped out of the race. Tell me why you wanted to be president. I think it's actually difficult for a lot of people to understand why someone would want to be president. Yes, there's the kind of power of it and everything, but there's so many headaches involved with the office, and there are so many seemingly unsolvable problems that are laid at the president's feet. Why did you want the job? And I mean, you've been in politics long enough to know about the kind of frustrations that you have campaigning for such a job.
I said during the campaign that I felt an obligation of my survival. When I left Washington in 1984, I never thought that I would come back into politics at any level, let alone run for president. But I've been out in the private side. I see what's happening to this country in terms of its economy. I know what the implications of that are long term. And so I felt strongly that I knew where we had to go. I wrote the book, A Call to Economic Arms. And my thought at that point was to do a book tour, to endorse somebody else, run in New Hampshire, or run across the country. So that's where it came from. If you remember when I got into this thing, George Bush was at 91%. I was dismissed as a serious candidate. It was Greek. I was from Massachusetts. I've had cancer. I have no office, etc. But I believe passionately in the ideas and strategies that were in my book. And my feeling was, as my wife said, that we have an obligation to the world our children are going to live in. And we felt that very strongly. So when I announced my candidacy, I had never lost an election. And I was very proud of what I had done. And I knew damn well that when I got into this thing that there would be a level of ridicule. But it didn't bother me because I felt that for whatever reason that I had survived my cancer and that I felt that obligation. And therefore, the running, in essence, this sense of obligation insulated me from worrying about what people thought. And I think, obviously, I've changed the debate in the Democratic Party and I feel fulfilled.
Do you feel that you succumbed to any campaigning pressures and ended up doing things that you didn't really want to do, but you knew you had to do to stay viable?
I guess the one thing that I have a sense that I gave into was a schedule that was inhuman. The fact is that we were so concerned about the media's focus on my stamina, which was a nonsense issue, but they were so focused on it, that we simply ran a schedule that would pour me into the streets and engaged in activity at a pace that was simply not sustainable, particularly someone like me who has a need for 8 hours sleep a night. You're running on 5-6 hours, and eventually you pay a price for that. I remember during the end, I would be giving speeches and would almost wake up in the middle of them. I'm not sure my audience did, but to give you a metaphor, analogy, if everyone's driven down a highway and your mind kind of slips into other thinking, you sort of snap 2 or 3 miles down the road and wonder how you got there. Well, that was happening to me during the campaign. I'd be in the middle of a speech and sort of wake up 10 minutes later in the speech and wonder, God, I hope I stuck to what I was supposed to talk about. And that was a function of being tired, and we gave in. We gave in to the pressure to have that kind of a schedule, and if I ever do it again, I would not repeat that mistake.
Well, I remember seeing all the pictures of you in your swim trunks the day that the press came to watch you swim, which was also an attempt to prove that you were, you know, really healthy and energetic. What was that like for you that day? Was there anything embarrassing about having to, you know, like, strip to your trunks and swim in front of, you know, the national press?
Well, you know, I've competed now for 3 years in my
Cedar
bathing
right.
suit, so
right.
I'm used to that. You know, it's funny because my focus at that point was, I'm 51, so you know, I don't have the body I had when I swam in college. And I'm so used to mentally thinking of myself in the photographs of the Dartmouth swimming team that when I would see myself in the photographs that were in the paper, I would lament my aging process. But other than that, the only concern I actually had was how well I would swim. If you remember, the ad we ran in the campaign was an ad of me doing the butterfly, which won an award as the best ad of the campaign. And that, it's interesting because we did that very purposefully. It was a way of not only making the argument about swimming against the tide, which was the kind of theme of the campaign, but by using a stroke like the butterfly, which the vast majority of people cannot do, it was a way of saying to people, look, he can swim the butterfly, you can't, so stop worrying about his health. And so it was a very purposeful attempt to say, you can make your own judgments, just look at him. What was interesting during the campaign was that people would come up to me and say, I saw your butterfly ad, I thought it was wonderful. Who did the swimming?
They thought you had a stunt double?
That's what they thought. It was, and I would tell them, I did it. And they would look at you like, well, okay, I hear you, and I'm supposed to believe you, but I really don't.
Huh. Now, how does an idea like this come up? Not the campaign ad, but the idea of swimming for the national press. How did that come up in the campaign? What was the process of conversation like in deciding whether you should do it or not?
Well, it was never. What happened was that I had intended, no matter the fact that I was running, that I would compete in the nationals. I had competed last year in the YMCA nationals, and this year had signed up for both the Y Nationals and the Masters Nationals, which is the highest level of competition in Masters swimming. And so I had intended, irrespective of the campaign, to swim in that those competitions. So I would try to schedule during the day, maybe 3 days a week, a workout. So it wasn't that these were staged for the media, but rather they were on my schedule anyway, and I did it constantly. But there was one day when I was finally a serious candidate that all these pools began to fuse together in my mind. But there were 36 cameras when I went to work out between still photographers and the TV cameras. And what's interesting about it is you cannot do a normal workout with that kind of attention, because what you do is you swim faster than you would normally, and you simply get out of your rhythm and you exhaust yourself. So when I was swimming, I realized I was swimming too fast, but I didn't have the courage to slow down because I thought I would look like a very average swimmer when the people turned on the television sets and saw me. So, and I would do a lot more butterfly and a lot less freestyle, and at the end, I would go back into the locker room and say, you fool, but I would do the same thing the next time.
We'll get back to our 1992 interview with Paul Tsongas after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We're listening to a 1992 interview with Paul Tsongas, former senator from Massachusetts. He died last Saturday. We spoke after he dropped out of the Democratic presidential primary in 1992. During his campaign, the issue he emphasized was the economy, one of the most complex issues to get across. I asked him about the obstacles he faced in talking meaningfully about the economy.
Well, I think the obstacles were really no different than perhaps you find in any democratic society. I gave a speech the other day to a journalism class, and I said, I went over and picked up a newspaper, and I said, put yourself in this situation. The headline of the story on the front page is, Tsongas articulates position on world population link to economic development. Turn see page 15. I said, how many of you would really be interested in turning to page 15? Then I said, imagine a second story. Tsongas regrets having had harem in the 1980s. Turn to page 15. Well, I mean, it's obvious. And the question is, how do you break through that in a situation? What we ended up relying upon, surprisingly, was my book. That the demand for the book was so extraordinary, and that's where a lot of our volunteers came from, that people were ready to absorb 83 pages of our policy. But the problem was getting that through the mass media. And that's why I think the use of the Larry Kings, the use of talk programs, et cetera, is really very valuable, because rather than a 9-second, which is now the average soundbite on the nightly news, you have a capacity to articulate things in some depth. And I will tell you that one of the great changes in American politics is C-SPAN. I would invariably run into people who would come up to me and know my issues in some detail and who were supporters who had become, in essence, C-SPAN junkies, not unlike what your network does in trying to do things in some depth. And that's, I think, where people end up having a sense of the issues.
One of the things you were up against with the press in your campaign was that people referred to you as the anti-charisma candidate. And, I mean, in a Newsweek voter's guide, it described you as having a dweebish TV presence, and it said this would make it hard to rally the country with speeches. Reading all this charisma stuff reminded me of the comic Washington, the Mark Allen Stamety comic strip about Washington, where his Senator Bob Forehead has a charismatician who's, I mean, this is the most shallow candidate in the world, you know, and the job of the charismatician, of course, is to just kind of give him lots of charisma. How important do you think charisma should be in a voter's decision to elect somebody?
Well, I don't think it can be dismissed. There is charisma and there is charisma. I think ideas have real power. And no one ever accused me. I used to say that when I would introduce my wife, that I did not have charisma, but I had enough sense to marry it. And she was someone who could really, on a television set, just project. And I don't know where you get it, and if I could go and buy it, I would. But the fact is that Nikki was able to do that. I've never been able to do that. So I have to rely upon the soundness of my ideas and people's perceiving my commitment to these ideas. So I think you can lead people. I mean, look at Ross Perot. I find it intriguing watching Ross Perot. And they used to accuse me of being too short. I think I'm 3 inches taller than he is. That I was non-charismatic in terms of my telegenic qualities. Well, if I was non-charismatic, I don't know what you say about him, but he has the charisma based on people's perception that this guy will go in there and do what's necessary. So it may not be the kind of Robert Redford in The Candidate kind of charisma, but I think ideas do have power, particularly at a time when people are scared stiff about where their country is going. And there's no doubt in my mind that that is what Ross Perot is tied into.
What kind of critique sessions would you do of yourself on television so that you could, you know, project better? Was that a regular part of the campaigning process?
Well, it wasn't in the beginning. I was pretty stubborn about things and said, look, I'm into this. Seems absurd in the retelling. I'm into this campaign because of issues. I'm not going to be handled, that kind of thing. And then one day, excuse me, my wife made the point that she said, look, Paul, you're really being a fool here. The fact is, we got into this race to get these ideas articulated, and all the press is talking about is your lack of telegenic capabilities. So why don't you acknowledge that and overcome it so people will listen to what you're talking about? And we reached out to a woman, Joyce Tsongas, who was married previously to my cousin in Portland, Oregon, and she came and we began that process. And I must say, I regret having been so mulish in the beginning, because by the time she had worked with us and I did the later TV debates, we did quite well.
What's the first thing you would change about the campaign process if you had the power to change it?
It's interesting. I get that question all the time. And people, I think, presume that since I lost, that I would feel very strongly that the system is wrong, that the definition of a system is one you can win. But I must say, I really would not change it. I think there have been some major changes in terms of the most important reform was matching funds. The federal government matching contributions up to $250. That is what kept us alive. And I think if nothing else, that is going to give people who are outsiders, who are ideas people, who are not taking PAC money, the opportunity to compete. The only change that I really call for is with the press, that when somebody like me comes along in the future who holds no office, who is not taking PAC money, who has very limited capacity to raise money, don't write us off. Give us the same chance you give someone who holds office. If I had not gotten sick, been elected to the Senate reelected in 1984, and then reelected in 1990, and run for president, I would not have been treated the way I had been. So the presumption was that having gone through the battle with cancer, having been in the private sector, made me a lesser person, a lesser qualified, if you will, to be president than if I had stayed in Washington and served in the Senate. That is absurd. So my comment to the press was, if people come along, give them a chance and let them disprove their capabilities. Don't presume them.
You were the first presidential candidate to have had cancer. Health was an issue, but you seemed to really be able to more or less put that behind you. But after you dropped out of the race, it was revealed that you had a node with cancerous cells as late as 1987, which was a year after your experimental treatment. And some doctors said that that was actually very significant because it showed the bone marrow transplant that you had didn't cure you. And that raised the question, why wasn't this information brought up sooner?
Well, what happened was that that information was no secret. When it happened, for example, the reporters here in Boston of the Boston Globe were aware of it. And at the time, it didn't mean a heck of a lot to us because over time, there was no indication of cancer, number one. Secondly, there was an article in the Boston Magazine that specifically talked about the node and the fact that it was cancerous. So this was an open issue. During the campaign, I told a reporter from the Washington Post about the node. What had happened was that I've been through so many experiences after the bone marrow transplant with things that are frightening and potentially serious. When you do a CAT scan, things show up and you do them 3 days later, they're not there again, those kinds of things. So the node was viewed as a happenstance, and my doctor told me 3 or 4 years ago, we're not sure what it means. So in the process of trying to deal with survival, you simply don't focus on these things and let them dominate your thinking. Now, what had happened was I had mentioned that to a couple of reporters, but the doctors did not mention it to the New York Times reporter when he did the feature story on my health, and they should have. But it wasn't viewed by them to be that significant, and the fact is if we were trying to keep it secret, the last thing I would have done was to tell the Washington Post about the node. But I think the press legitimately felt that, however we may have felt about the node, that my doctors, et cetera, that should have been referred to more prominently than it was. So in retrospect, I think it's clear that a mistake was made, and to be able to say, well, we told other reporters, really doesn't give the New York Times reporter any comfort.
How public do you think a candidate's medical record should be?
Well, I think normally they should be private, but in the case of someone like me who's had cancer, I think they have the right to access. I don't like it. And what I've done is I've asked Dana-Farber, and they did it on their own, to duplicate all of my records and to seal them and send them to me. So I now have that, and I said if I ever were to surface again on the national political scene, those records would be available to the press and to other physicians and let them decide what they wish to decide. And that's a heck of a precedent to set, and I do it with great reluctance, but I think in my case I have no choice.
The experimental treatment that you went through for cancer was, I know, very painful. Part of the
It was not painful.
Well, no, here's what I'm thinking of. When you had to get your bone drilled to see if the treatment was appropriate, you had to get your bone drilled and marrow taken out to see if the cancer had spread. And that sounded like a really, really miserable process. The anesthetic does not apparently affect the bone pain. How did you deal with the pain?
Well, the first couple of times I went through that, I spent my time commiserating with myself and feeling sorry for myself. And it's about 20 minutes, a half an hour, and it's very painful. But one day I figured out while I was lying there that, you know, there are a lot of people, thousands of people, who have been tortured. And the fact is they don't undergo 20 minutes of pain. They undergo hours of pain. The people who are inflicting it upon them are not friends who really care for you and physicians, but they are tormentors, and they don't get out. A half an hour from now, you're going to be out. You're going to get back in your car and drive home to a family that cares for you. So what the hell are you complaining about? And once you look at it in that perspective, it seems very endurable.
Paul Tsongas, recorded in 1992. He died Saturday at the age of 55. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the poet once described as a bare-chested bard. We remember James Dickey, who died last weekend. He's best known for his novel Deliverance. Also, Milo Miles tells us about the white blues singer Tracy Nelson, and Ed Ward remembers veteran bluesman ZZ Hill. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Music critic Milo Miles would like to introduce or reintroduce you to singer Tracy Nelson. Before her recent reissues, he was afraid she was lost in the woods forever.
When you went away, I cried for so long. I wanted you to stay.
Down So Low is the soul masterpiece most closely associated with Tracy Nelson, but it's only the beginning. She belongs in the very elite of white blues and R&B vocalists, but until now her biggest problems are that she has been releasing mediocre solo albums for more than 20 years, and that her best work has been out of print for almost that long. Not anymore. Warner Brothers has put together a collection called The Best of Tracy Nelson / Mother Earth, which was the name of her band in the late 60s and early 70s. As a bonus, the company has also brought back an entire landmark album, Mother Earth Presents Tracy Nelson Country, her stunning version of the Nashville sound. Actually, Nelson began as the most impressive member of the group Mother Earth, not the outright leader. It was a true field hippie roots rock band, mostly from Texas, and their albums Living with the Animals and Make a Joyful Noise included cosmic and comic numbers written and sung by musicians other than Nelson. So there's a certain eclectic, ineffable buzz missing when Mother Earth is reduced to Tracy Nelson. But in truth, hers are the timeless tracks.
Well, I need softness just to feel next to mine. I need someone to stand up and, well, tell me everything's all right. Listen. Listen to my plea. Bring it on home. Well, I need your love so bad. Well, I need, don't you know that I need your love so bad. Well, I need it, I need.
Tracy Nelson won my heart forever way back when she convinced me she needed my love so bad. Not just somebody's love, not anybody's love, not your love, my love. The song was written by one of the champion heavyweights of soul, Little Willie John, and it's quite a testament that Nelson's rendition fights his to a draw. She always selected vivid, perceptive material to cover, including Eric Kaz's Temptation Took Control of Me and I Fell, and Steve Young's Seven Bridges Road, and Mother Earth itself, the sardonic blues by Memphis Slim that the band borrowed for its name. But beyond material, Nelson triumphed through the irresistible emotional conviction of her vocals. She sang some put-downs and celebrations of independence, but her specialties were lust and suffering and a sharp sense of sin. All that gave her an immense boost as a honky-tonk blueser on the Tracy Nelson Country record. She also seemed to understand that in the South there's a huge overlap between the white country and the black blues audiences. They both love a low-down lament that cuts to the quick. You just got to do the thing with soul.
Well, I've known some sad situations before, and I faced a lot of temptations before. By now, I guess I
Tracy Nelson Country was cut in less than a week. Whether it was the novelty of Barefoot Blues Mama meets the Nashville Straits or just youthful inspiration, Nelson and guitarist Scotty Moore, drummer DJ Fontana, fiddler Johnny Gimble, the Jordanaires Chorus, and the rest came up with a collection of cuts as solid and intoxicating as any made by established country stars in that era. Don't miss Tracy Nelson's classic sides this time around. The heartbreak is that nowadays she makes albums that are infinitely more carefully prepared than her work with ragtag old Mother Earth, and they don't work nearly as well.
Milo Miles is a writer living in Cambridge. The Best of Tracy Nelson, Mother Earth, and Mother Earth Presents Tracy Nelson Country are reissued on the Reprise Archives label. Coming up, we remember James Dickey. This is Fresh Air. We're going to remember poet and novelist James Dickey. He died last Sunday at the age of 73 of complications related to lung disease. He won the National Book Award for Poetry in 1966 and is perhaps best known for his novel Deliverance, which was adapted into the 1972 film. The story is about four suburban men who take a canoe trip and are preyed on by demented backwoodsmen who rape them and shoot them with bows and arrows. In the most famous scene, the backwoodsmen are leading two of the canoers, played by John Voight and Ned Beatty, into the woods at gunpoint.
Well, gentlemen, we can talk this thing over. What is it you require of us?
Well, we require that you get your goddamn ass up in them woods.
All right, now, right look.
You get right now, Peter.
Okay, all right.
Get up there.
All right.
Faster, boy. Move that ass.
Take easy with that weapon you got in your hand.
You too, shut up. Come on.
Okay.
Right on.
It's all
right
in
there.
Trouble here.
Oh, you're in trouble.
Just don't argue with him, Ed. Don't.
Wait, come on. See that sapling over
there? You heard him here, man.
I want you back up against this.
Is this a matter of money, you gentlemen?
We want money. We'll take the money back up against the tree.
Yeah.
Put your back.
Pretty far back
like
against
that. All right, stay just there. Now be still. Be real still.
I spoke with James Dickey in 1993 after the publication of his novel To the White Sea about an American tail gunner whose plane is shot down over Tokyo just before the firebombing of that city during World War II. He's on his own in enemy territory. His instincts tell him to head north to the wilderness where it's too cold for most men to live and he stands a chance of finding safety. The novel is about how he survives against his enemies and the elements. I asked James Dickey why he was interested in that theme.
I have always been attracted to that element in fiction when someone else wrote it. And I'm not equipped to write novels of the higher crusts of society like Henry James or Edith Wharton or someone like that, or Lewis Auchincloss. I couldn't do it. I don't have the knowledge of it. And above all, I don't have the interest in it. But something like this I have a great interest in, a survival situation. The American poet Alan Tate once told me, he said, Jim, I sometimes think of my poems as commentaries on those human situations from which there's no escape. And I'm very sympathetic to that attitude, and that's what I try to comment on, too, in what I write.
Now, I think it was when you were flying missions during World War II that you first started to read poetry seriously.
Well, yes, I read a lot of things, and the things, the prose things, novels and so on that I read had a certain quality that I liked. I could tell that I had rather read a writer named William Faulkner than one named James T. Farrell, who's a very prosaic and matter-of-fact and rather journalistic type of a writer. Then I sort of dimly recognized early on that there was some difference in kind between Faulkner and James T. Farrell. And I finally saw, after some time, that the quality that I wanted was more concentrated and better expressed in poetry than it was in prose fiction. So gradually, I sort of gravitated over to poetry went with that more than I did any other kind of reading that I did.
Well, how did you end up reading more while you were flying missions during World War II?
Well, when you're overseas, you're in a squadron if you're not actually flying in combat missions and so on. You have a good deal of time. We had a squadron library. There was sort of a miscellaneous assortment of your armed services editions and so on, and I read whatever was there and so on. And then when I got back from overseas in the early part of 1946, I had some money accumulated from being over there for a good while, and I went to New York and I just bought a lot of books and read them, you know, and everything just sort of built up from that.
Then you went back to college too, right?
I started all over as a first-term freshman at Vanderbilt. I had been for a semester at Clemson where I didn't take any interest in books or intellectual pursuits, poetry, anything else. I was strictly an athlete. I was kind of an average college football player and not the best. I had my moments, but nothing, no superstar. But my main interest up to that time was sports. But the war changed everything, changed my values, and I came back and I didn't go back to Clemson to play ball. I didn't have to play football anymore for a college education. I had the GI Bill, so I just enrolled as a freshman at Vanderbilt, which had a good intellectual and artistic tradition. I wanted what Vanderbilt had. I had no interest in what Clemson had.
When you say the war changed your values, what are some of the values that changed that affected how you lived your life afterwards?
I had the beginnings of a lifelong interest in the imagination and its works. Everything came out of those years. And when I went to Vanderbilt, I concentrated on that and went on from there.
Was it a different world, the world of literature?
Yes, indeed.
From the world of athletics that you were used to?
Yes, it certainly was different and unendingly fascinating. The more I found out, the more I wanted to find out. And it goes on today, as they say in the awful jargon of our time, as we speak.
Well, I'm sure the people were different, too, than the people who you had been used to?
Yeah, but I like them, too. I mean, I like football players and coaches and athletes and so on very much still. But my interest in them is relatively limited, and my connection with them and my social, concordance with them is relatively slight. But the main people that I find a rapport with are the people who are in some way in the arts. It doesn't have to be literature or poetry. It can be in a drama, it can be in dance, music, and so on.
Did you find a way early on in your writing to write about the physical things that interested you?
No, I wrote about things that stuck in my mind. Very early on, I came to the as far as the choice of subject matter was concerned, my only rule of thumb is that if something keeps recurring to me without any apparent reason for it to keep coming back to my mind, then I know it's a potential subject because I can't get rid of it. I know that, I have to deal with it. I have to write about it in some way, whether right or wrong, good or bad.
I think you're probably best known for your novel Deliverance, and you also wrote the screenplay for the film adaptation. What was the inspiration for that story?
Well, I usually start anything I write with an image, as I said earlier, one of these obsessional images. I was sort of taking a siesta in Italy in 1962, and I saw, it just came to me. I had no intention my train of thought, such as it was not, didn't have anything to do with this. But I just saw a man standing at the top of a cliff. I didn't know how he had gotten there, whether he came from the woods at the edge. Immediately they materialized woods in the picture. I didn't know whether he had just come out to the edge of the cliff and was looking around there, or whether maybe he had come up the cliff for some reason. what would be the reason? So gradually the story took hold of me, and in a few minutes, I don't know how many, but I knew the whole story. I knew who the people were going to be. I knew what was where it was going to take place. I knew what was going to happen to them, pretty much, and so on. And I just made some notes and went back to sleep, and everything started working out of that beginning.
I think the scene that made the biggest impact in Deliverance, the movie, and probably in Deliverance, the novel, is the scene where one of the characters is raped.
Well, that's famous. I can't really say justly famous, but famous it is. Bobby is the boy, the salesman, is the one that is the victim. That scene isn't necessary to the novel because the reader is going to want to see something terrible happen to that man that perpetrated the rape. Billy McKinney, who played him, and I thought he did a wonderful job. I would not be averse to saying that he was the best thing in the movie, although I have great praise for everybody else in it, too. I remember when he came up on the set, and I said to him, Billy, Mr. McKinney, you have one function in this movie. That audience is going to have to hate you. He says, don't worry, Mr. Dickey, they're going to hate me. Have you ever seen anybody that you'd rather see get shot in the back with an arrow more than that guy? And so on. So he did very good. He did a good job on that. He was very convincing.
Do you think that part of what made the rape scene so shocking to audiences was the fact that it was one man raping another man?
Well, that's shocking enough. But the most shocking thing about it, and the thing that makes you so disgusted and even terrified about it, is the humiliation of the fat boy, you know, making him squeal like a pig and all that stuff. That's, I mean, if you're going to assault somebody sexually, you don't have to do all that, you know. But the fact that he does it makes him singularly depraved and repulsive.
Do you think that this scene also, you know, played on people's fears of homosexuality?
Well, again, that's not really what I had in mind at all. What I wanted to do was to have a scene which would bring into focus the most abiding and the deepest fear of people in our time and our century, which is the fear of being set upon by malicious strangers.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to happen off in the woods of North Georgia. It can happen on the streets of New York or any other city. To be assaulted by people who had just as soon kill you as look at you. In fact, some of them had rather. That's the fear of our time. And I wanted to use that motif and as a lead in to what happens in the rest of the story.
You know, I think that's a fear that most Americans live with, and you live with it in one way in a city and in a different way in the country.
Yeah, it's much worse in the city because there's so many more people. But it's bad enough at any time or any place.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
James Dickey recorded in 1993. He died Sunday at the age of 73. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on blues singer ZZ Hill. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Veteran bluesman ZZ Hill defied the odds and scored hits during the most unlikely of musical times. Rock historian Ed Ward traces his legacy.
Hey, you were wrong. You were wrong.
In 1982, ZZ Hill did the impossible. In a black music scene seething with the first rap records, where funk and the remnants of disco competed with each other, he managed to make a place for blues, good old down-home blues. Any knowledgeable observer would have told you that blues was a relic, its popularity long gone, only viable in the South. Young people didn't go for it, they'd say. Yet here was this veteran blues man putting singles in the top 20 and selling albums like crazy. Like most overnight successes, this one was about 20 years in the making. Arzelle Hill was born in 1941 in Naples, Texas, south of Dallas, and grew up idolizing Sam Cooke. After an apprenticeship in gospel music, Hill started haunting the Deep Ellum clubs in Dallas, singing with any band that would let him on stage. Somewhere along the way, he decided Arzelle wasn't exactly a star's name, so he decided on ZZ, well before ZZ Top. When his brother Matt called from San Diego and told him that he'd started a record label, it didn't take ZZ long to chuck his truck driving job and head west. In March 1964, he released his first record, You Were Wrong, and it miraculously scraped the bottom of the Billboard pop charts for 1 week. The Hill Brothers label died after a couple of follow-ups failed to make any noise, and ZZ was signed to Kent, where B.B. King ruled supreme. Reluctantly, Kent let him go, and he bounced around a bunch of small labels that sound like a soul collector's want list. Along the way, he stopped at one called Mankind and recorded a masterpiece in 1971.
Well, this young man could have made your life a big bowl of cherries. Well, there's hard times to go through. If you can take a poor man's trials and tribulations, darling, here's your consolation. I'm faithful.
Reunited with his brother, ZZ signed a deal for Hill Records to be distributed by United Artists in 1972, and finally scored another hit in 1973 with his version of a Bobby Bland classic.
When you got a headache powder soothes the pain. When you try to rest, Lord, you feel all right again. When you got a backache, a little rubbing will see you through. When you got a heartache, there ain't nothing you can do. A man can't break a stone.
United Artists felt that a change of groove might do ZZ some good, and in 1974, they released an album half produced by former Motown whiz Lamont Dozier and half by New Orleans master Alan Toussaint. This produced his biggest record in a while, from the New Orleans sessions.
I keep on grieving, I keep on leaving.
I Keep On Loving You was his last hit for the label, though, and the next couple of years were bleak. His brother Matt died in 1975, and the sort of soul ZZ sang was fast getting eclipsed by disco. For some reason, Columbia Records took a chance on him, though, and again, he did well, but not too well, delivering two hits, Love Is So Good When You're Stealing It, and another masterpiece, This Time They Told the Truth.
Have you heard what they've been saying about us? Seem like we're the talk of the town. They say we act like we're in love, the way we've been slipping around. Just the other day, I heard someone say, I would leave my family for you.
But again, he wasn't making enough money for a major label to keep him under contract, and he found himself back on the Chitlin' circuit playing to his old fans. In 1980, he signed with a Mississippi label, Malico, just to make sure he had something out, and that's when the miracle hit.
Everybody's having a good time, and you know what's going through my mind. Do you mind if I get comfortable and kick off these shoes? While you fixing me a drink,
Down Home Blues sold and sold and got played on the radio. At long last, ZZ Hill was vindicated, but the victory was short-lived. He collapsed and died of a heart attack in Dallas in April 1984. His legacy, though, is a profound one. No matter what's happening in the world of black music, people now know that you can't keep the blues down for long.
Ed Ward is a writer currently living in Berlin.
Let them talk if they want to.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Fred Snyder, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
What world you know that I love you so? What's between